Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning and welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. You've got Julian Paul here live as usual in the studio. We'll be talking to our PG later in the show. He's got a great track, so who knows what he's talking about? Could be to do with life. Our guest speaker this Saturday, and indeed every third Saturday of the month, is Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, one of the oldest photographic societies in the country, if not the oldest, but I'm not sure about that anymore. Coming up soon as well is their annual exhibition at Sheffield Cathedral. It's free, I believe, and it runs from Friday the 28th of March until Sunday the 6th of April. Well worth going to see. The cathedral's great anyway, and there's a great cafe there too. Next up, I saw this article in the press and I thought it's really interesting, as we are sort of into spring. Fascinating facts about spring then. Spring arrives 9 days earlier than it used to. Now, our chiff-chaff, we always make a note when they hear the first chiff-chaffs come back, and indeed they are earlier, aren't they? So plant growth in spring depends largely on two things: longer days, which mean more light is available for plants to use for energy, and temperature, which holds back growth in cold springs and accelerates it in warmer springs. Climate change is driving a broadly warming trend, heating spring faster than the other seasons. The average temperature in the UK has risen by 1.8 degrees Celsius since 1970. While according to the Joint Nature Conservation Committee, which advises the government, the season of spring is arriving 9 days earlier than it did 25 years ago. Next, I thought this was fascinating. It's 8 degrees Celsius warmer inside a daffodil trumpet than outside. So the temperature inside daffodil trumpets can be up to 8 degrees Celsius warmer than the surrounding air. The cone acts as a windbreak. The stem pivots the trumpet away from chilly breezes, while the petals direct the sun inwards, a bit like a photographic reflector. There's a clever reason for these adaptations. The daffodil wants to be pollinated. And warmth is attractive to bees on cold spring days as it allows them to raise their body heat enough to keep foraging and thus survive. At night, bees sometimes sleep inside crocus flowers, which close at dusk like little sleeping bags. Who knew that, eh? Fascinating. Next up, scientists have calculated that spring travels at approximately 2 miles per hour. How can that be? Well, it takes 3 weeks or so for spring to move from the southwest of the UK to the northeast. So if you're driving north in May, you can watch from your car window as hawthorn blossom travels back in time from heavy cream weighing down the Dorset hedges to scattered constellations of opening flowers at the field edges in Midlands to tight little buds like fairylights in Northumberland still waiting to be switched on. According to Nature's Calendar, a citizen data recording project with information dating back to 1736, when measured by natural phenomena like the appearance of frog spawn, blackthorn, blossom and bluebells, spring progresses at about 2 miles per hour, the speed of a person out for a leisurely stroll. All interesting. And finally, the secrets of birds' spring plumage. I found this interesting because it's something I didn't know. Most birds only molt into new feathers once, and that's around August. So how on earth do their feathers become brighter for the spring breeding season? Well, the answer is in many species, the outer edges of a new set of feathers are comparatively dull, giving the birds some camouflage over winter, especially important when the trees are leafless and survival is already hard. By spring, though, the outer parts of those feathers wear away to show the brighter colours underneath, making the birds look smart and clean. With more food around, they can afford to take a few risks and show off, and it's all worth it if they attract a mate. Track there from Susie and the Banshees, of course, Unmistakable Sound, that painted bird, because we're talking about fascinating facts about spring, including the secret of birds' spring plumage. All interesting stuff. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, talking about science in all its different forms. Next up, Weather Eye, Breckland, all very intriguing, if you ask me.
It was a glorious spring day over much of the UK on Thursday, 6th of March, with warm sunshine and a light breeze. And Sandton Downham in West Suffolk was the warmest place in the country this year with a high of 19°C. Sandton Downham is a well-known for remarkable temperatures, and on March 29th, 1968, the temperature touched 25°C, close to setting a UK record for March. Sandton Downham lies in an area known as the Breckland, with sandy soil that can rapidly heat up in warm sunshine during the day, but at night rapidly losing heat and turn exceptionally cold. This can lead to some wild swings in temperature. On March the 30th, 2021, the temperature soared by more than 20 C in less than 4 hours, from minus 1.6 C early in the morning to 19 C just before 11 a.m. The sandy soils of the Breckland are left over from the Ice Age when cold, dry winds swept down from the great ice sheets and blew sand over the tundra landscape at that time. And when the ice sheets melted at the end of the Ice Age, that may also have washed sand over the land. That legacy left the Breckland covered in sand dunes and led to some tremendous windstorms during the 1600s. One particular sandstorm in 1688 engulfed Stanton Downham and the surrounding area. Several houses were almost entirely buried. The nearby river was blocked, many lanes were impassable, and fields were swamped.
Wow, who knew, eh? A legend about the local church also claims that a red brick placed about 6 metres high up on the church tower marks the height of the sand left from the remarkable storm. The author and artist William Gilpin described the area as such a piece of absolute desert, almost in the heart of England. Native to the Breckland is the tiny perennial narwhal plant with star-like flowers, one of the UK's rarest plants found nowhere else in the world. But by the 1930s, development of forestry in particular led to the disappearance of many of the sand dunes. Who knew, eh? So the sandy soils of Breckland left over from the Ice Age. I'm going to go and look on the map and see where Stanton Downham is. I suppose the unmistakable sound there of another band, Metallica, of course, Enter Sandman. And we played that because we're talking about Breckland, Sandham, Downham and the sandy soils. All exciting stuff. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lovely morning it is.
It is. Still a bit chilly. even though, yeah, spring should be here. But so what's caught your eye in the science news this week then?
Well, it's an interesting one from Australia, and a sort of bit of a confusing lead on it. The man with the golden arm. And I thought, is this about the new Bond? But no, sadly, it's news of the man with the golden arm who's passed away at the age of 88. And he's an Australian man who was credited with saving 2.4 million babies through his record-breaking blood plasma donations over six decades. So, despite him being scared of needles, James Harrison was a retired State Railway Department clerk. He died in a nursing home at Central Coast, New South Wales, on the 17th of February. And he'd been surprised to be recognised in the Guinness World Records of 2005 as the person who donated the most blood plasma in the world. He made 1,173 donations, and after he turned 18 in 1954, right through until he was forced to retire in 2018. And they say he did it for all the right reasons, his grandson says. The Australian Red Cross Blood Service said Harrison was renowned as the man with the golden arm. His record was beaten in 2022 by an American called Brett Cooper. But Mr. Harrison's plasmas contained a rare antibody known as anti-D, which is used to make injections that protect unborn babies from hemoglottic disease of the newborn.
Wow, what a great story. Where did you find that?
That was in the Eye paper sort of a week or so ago, I think. And I say, it's just the thing of the man with the golden arm. I just sort of thought, they're looking for their new James Bond. Maybe it's that. But no, I think it's
what a great story. It just shows that one person, what an impact one person can have just over time.
Yeah, I think an amazing story. So very good. I'm going to then wander off into some of the quantum worlds, I think.
Which we tried to touch on before.
Yeah. But this is some new research from the University of Sheffield, which is about understanding of black holes. And that includes time and a mysterious dark energy that dominates the universe. So their new search suggests that black holes may transition into white holes that eject matter. So a black hole is the thing where it sucks everything into it, and in theory nothing came back out again. But this challenges it with a transition into white holes that eject matter and potentially even time back into the universe.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Instead of taking time away, it's going to give us time, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the quantum physics is one of those things we've tried talking through it before.
Oh, it's complicated stuff.
I remember, Paul.
It's very good, yeah. But they say this is a proposal that there's a revolutionary link between time and dark energy, and suggests that this mysterious force that's driving the universe's expansion may be used to measure time. And maybe that will come together in another story I've got to sort of follow this. But our understanding of black holes, time, and this dark energy could be revolutionised by this research that the University of Sheffield is undertaking. So according to Einstein's theory of relativity, anyone trapped inside a black hole would fall towards its centre and be destroyed by immense gravitational forces. That center point is known as a singularity, and it's the point where the matter of a giant star, which is believed to have collapsed to form the black hole, is crushed down into something infinitesimally tiny. I'll just put my teeth back in after that.
It's not easy to say, is it? At least we're all on live radio.
This is a new paper that they've released titled Black Hole Singularity Resolution in Unimodular Gravity from Unitarity.
Good. Cool. Blimey, you need a degree just to read the title, Paul.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Well, you can do if you want. It's in the scientific journal Physical Review Letters, published on the 11th of March. And it's trying to illustrate the point where our current grasp of physics and time falters. So it is one of the things that when we talked about quantum theory, there are points where you move from knowledge to faith or your best guesses and things. So how do we step forward from that? So while black holes are often described as sucking everything, including time, into a point of nothingness, in this paper they say that white holes are theorized to act in the reverse, ejecting matter, energy and time back into the universe. And that's just kind of a weird thing, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Yeah, because time's a sort of concept as well, so it's very, very weird. But it uses a simplified theoretical model of the black hole known as a planar hole, in which it looks at it rather than being a spherical sort of donut hole with a dark centre. It's actually a flat two-dimensional surface that they look at it. And it's long been a question as to whether quantum mechanics can change our understanding of black holes and give insights. So this is Dr. Stefan Gehlen from the University of Sheffield School of Mathematical and Physical Sciences, who co-wrote a paper with Lucia Mendez-Pidal from Complutense, the University of Madrid.
You're doing brilliant on the pronunciation, Paul, because generally all these doctors and researchers have the most difficult names to pronounce.
Well, I think this is a sort of short form version of it. Oh, actually, the full paper is available on the sheffield.ac.uk website in their news area. So, an interesting thing. So,
good luck. I mean, have they been funded by somebody or?
No. It's they're not crediting anything. It's just an ongoing work, but obviously it's a new hypothesis which is not there. But say you can read the paper in full with a link on the university's website. And then just as a breather after that, I think some work came out that we've talked about before. And it's about the power of green nature. So nature can work as a painkiller and could pave the way for new treatments. So I think the exposure to nature may change the way the brain responds to the processing of pain, this study suggests. And scans showed that the activity linked to pain perception was reduced when people were shown videos of natural scenes compared to images of city life and the inside of an office.
Yeah.
So it's a study led by Max Steininger, a PhD student at the University of Vienna. Numerous studies have shown that people consistently report feeling less pain when exposed to nature. And yet, until now, the underlying reasons for this effect were unclear. So this study says that it is the first to provide evidence from brain scans that this isn't just a placebo effect driven by people's beliefs and expectations that nature is good for them. Instead, the brain is reacting less to information about where the pain is coming from and how intensely it feels. So he said that his team's findings, which are published in a journal called Nature Communications, suggests the pain effect of nature is genuine. So, Dr. Alex Smalley of Exeter University added, this study highlights how virtual encounters can bring the healing potential of nature to people when they cannot get outside. So basically just looking at images of the natural world can help out.
Very interesting.
We talk about genes quite a lot, and the some research that says the oldest person who died recently did have good genes. So they've decoded the microbiome of a woman who was the world's oldest living person before her death at 117 last year.
Blimey.
And they found that she really did have good genetics, which she claimed was the reason for her long life. The studies of the body of Maria Branius Moraes was determined that the genes she inherited allowed her cells to feel and behave as if they were 17 years younger.
Wow. So, I wonder if she's been anywhere near a white hole.
What she said was she'd avoided drinking alcohol and smoking, enjoyed good walks, constantly surrounded herself with family and loved ones. So that's the recipe, apparently.
Yeah. Well, indeed.
Yeah. So let me see if I can find me way through to...
Is your researcher letting you down, Paul?
Your research assistant. Well, he's talking about navigation and navigation. I brought this up a couple of weeks ago, that there have been attacks on aeroplane GPS systems, which confuse the systems, and they're sort of looking for how they can avoid that kind of problem. Obviously, nations who want to put off attacking aeroplanes, it'd be great if they could knock out the GPS, which stops them being able to find where they are and follow through and find the targets. So they've been spoofing the GPS systems. One of the recent ones that...
Is somebody ringing you up now? No, we love live radio, Paul. That's what makes it.
Just to keep me going, yeah. So I think it's... what they've done, one of the attacks was the clock within the GPS system. It's made to never go backwards in time. But one of these exploits was to make the clock go forwards in time. And like a lot of websites, sometimes their accreditation runs out and it's not being replaced. Well, effectively, that's what they did to a GPS system, was to run its clocks way forward until it ran out of its sell-by date.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of another thing, you know, I mean... you're looking at that. So what they're doing is they're starting to look into new clocks. So if you go back to navigation, we had Harrison who developed the marine clock to help with things after a long period of research and not a great deal of reward for
doing it. No, indeed not.
But this is a group of scientists in the UK called the Time Lords have been asked to come up with a new clock system. A lot of the GPS system relates now to a thing they developed way back in the National Physics Laboratory called the cesium clock. And that looks at the decay rate of cesium to be able to generate an accurate time. But they were big things. They were distributed to key places around the world so that the world could keep track of time. But this is a proposal now from the Time Lords to do what Harrison did. What he found out with his clocks was that as he managed to compact them down and make them smaller, he was better able to... protect them from the heat changes, the movement and other things that in a larger clock were difficult to achieve. So this is a proposal to come up with a new mini version of something like the cesium clock, which eventually they're saying you could put that and a gyroscope and an accelerometer into something like your mobile phone. So you could use that as GPS tracking and you wouldn't be at risk from the current exploits.
Very interesting.
So, again, it's a bit of quantum physics inside there, and to sort of talking about how long it could be. But there's definitely research underway to cut that tie from a remote clock to something that you can carry with you. So I thought, interesting, I think, and something else caught my eye, because while we've had this cold weather, my wonky old knees have been giving me a bit of trouble. And this is a bit of new science that says nose cartilage can be used to repair knees.
Oh.
So cartilage grown from the human nose cells can be used to repair serious injuries, research has shown. So an engineered cartilage from nasal septum cells was able to help treat complex damage to the articular cartilage, which is painful and seriously limits mobility. So I'm just wondering where I apply.
So. Amazing. It's amazing what things come through, isn't it?
Well,
research
kind of,
and development.
The background to why I chose the track I did, because an amazing range of things happening a day in the life.
There is.
Yes.
And you've covered a fair few there. I'm more interested in the white hole theory of getting time back.
Say, get to the university website, and it is quite good explanation, but the whole paper might take a bit of reading.
Yeah, a bit of concentration. Fantastic stuff as always, Paul. We'll speak to you at Glory Days Rock Show Monday 1 till 3.
Good old.
Bye-bye, bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was on the house floor. The army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away, but I just had to look. Having read the dream.
What a great track, A Day in the Life there from the Beatles way back in 67. It was the final track, I think, on Sgt. Pepper's album. Amazing. We played that, well, PG was talking about in Amazing What Happens Every Day, really, in the science world. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. We should have Gareth Morgan on the line. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us yet again. It seems only 2 minutes since we spoke to you last.
It's a short month, I think.
That's it, February. So for people who don't know, you are a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society.
I am.
And I must say, you're doing some great work on your social media accounts, Instagram, Facebook, you know, advertising what you do and exhibitions.
Yeah. We've stepped it up a bit, I think, which is good.
Yeah, some lovely stuff there. And so this week you're going to talk to us about the geometry of an image.
Yes. I thought we'd get a bit mathematical for a change.
Yes.
Well, it is a science programme after all.
It is.
So, I mean, if you think about photographs, they're mainly rectangular or sometimes square, but you know, even the word, you either get a portrait or a landscape format picture. Yeah. And by definition, that's a rectangle. It's very rare these days that you see circular images. I think, you know, exhibitions I've been going to for, God knows, 20-odd years, and I think I've only seen handfuls of circular images. And even then, it's usually the surround that is circular. The image itself is usually square. I have even seen one or two triangular ones, but that's very rare. So basically, we're talking about rectangular shapes. And this is a kind of carryover from the art world. So there's nothing new under the sun. What I'm going to talk about is kind of some of the rules of composition guidelines. They're not, you know, hard and fast rules in the true sense of the word. But we have talked about some of these before. So if you think about a rectangle, whether it's sideways on or stood up, there's something called the rule of thirds, which I think I have mentioned before. And that's where if you divide that rectangle into three sections going down and three sections going across, where those sections intersect is the ideal point to put your subject in any image. And why that is, I don't really know. I don't think anyone really knows. But aesthetically, it works. It does. And there is a mathematical, there's the whole concept of the golden mean, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that kind of, you know, since ancient times, that's worked. And if you think about some of the great works of art, think about The Fighting Temeraire or Van Gogh's Starry Night. You can see the rule of thirds being very carefully applied. And you see it through, you know, through art throughout the centuries. That's just a thing that's developed, that it's a logical place to put your subject. It looks well when you look at it. It's suits the way that the human eye interprets it, images.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the easiest thing to do when you're taking a picture is to just think about that. And you don't have to work out exactly what a third is, you know. It's kind of slightly off center, really, is what we're saying. And that's kind of one of the basic rules of composition in photography. The next one, which is slightly more complicated, is this thing called the golden ratio, or the golden mean, the golden sector. Lots of golden things. But essentially, if you take a line that's made up of two elements, A and B, if the ratio, this is going to get a bit complicated.
No, I've even drawn my rectangle and put the lines in.
Right, so if you draw one line, which is divided into two unequal elements. So you've got A and B. Now, B is, one of them is slightly longer or is longer than the other. If the ratio of A to B is the same as the ratio of B to the total, so are you with me, the bigger section to the total.
Right.
That gives you what's known as the golden ratio. And it's another one of those things that is aesthetically pleasing. See, if you take a lot of lines with that applied, you end up with a either a spiral or some sort of shape. And that, if you plot that on a graph, it gives you a very pleasing shape.
Oh, interesting.
It's very close to, you're familiar with the concept of the Fibonacci spiral?
Yes.
Which is like, if you think about it, you see it in nature a lot, but it's like a spiral that wraps around on itself and ends up on a kind of central point in the middle of the spiral. That spiral, that central point, is the ideal place to put your subject in a photograph. And it's quite near to where the third would be, quite coincidentally.
Yeah.
But that's what it's about. And the golden mean is, I mean, there's been all sorts of philosophical treatises on why this is the case. But it does work.
Wow.
It's a bit harder to keep in your head because it requires a bit of mass every time you do it. But, you know, the shortcut is to think about where your third line is.
Wow.
So those are geometrical factors that apply when you take your photographs. There are some even simpler ones. A diagonal in an image is always better than a straight line. Sometimes you can divide a picture with a straight line across the middle and it works. But you're often better to have a line that goes in diagonally. And if you get it going from the bottom corner into the picture, either the left-hand or the right-hand side, it becomes a leading line. And it takes your eye into the picture. And that gives you, again, if your subject is at the end, or if actually that becomes the subject in itself. If you imagine, you know, you stood on, you're on Route 66 in the Nevada desert. You've seen lots of pictures of somebody stood in the middle of the road and taken that photograph of the road stretching out in front of you.
Yes.
What you've got from either side is the two lines of the road converging to make a really strong image. And that's what leading lines can do. You can do it with railway tracks, with a pier at the seaside. I was down at Bristol a few months ago now and took some pictures on Clifton Pier where I stood bang in the middle and I've got the pier going out, wooden planks and all of that.
Yes.
To a really stormy sky. And it just works really well. And if I'd stood off centre, it wouldn't have worked as well, or if I'd tried to get it, you know, square on. I think just using those leading lines works really well.
It draws your eye. It's how the eye works, isn't it, as well?
Yeah,
it draws
it is. And
you
it follows,
in.
It follows lines. It follows things into an image. Another way of using that concept is either the pyramid or the triangle shape. And if you look at fashion pictures in particular, you'll often see a model will have one arm coming down and across, and the other one pointing back up. And that's to create a triangle that points to the face.
Right.
So you see that in lots of different types of compositions. So you're trying to get a triangle that makes you look at the thing you want the subject, you know, the viewer to focus on. And that's what photography is all about. You're trying to tell the viewer what it is you think is important in the subject. And if the viewer's eye wanders off to something else, you've lost their interest, really. So that, you know, so you've got straight lines, you've got triangles. What also works really well is an S-curve. So if you imagine a leading line going in, if that line actually was bent a bit like an S. So, you know, think of a forest track winding through the
yes.
trees. You've got like a bit of a curve one way and then the other way. You're just looking for pleasing shapes. But thinking about it in the form of an S is great. There's a particular picture from, which I love, from last year's Tour de France. As you know, I'm a big fan of, well, you probably don't know, I'm a big fan of cycling. And there's a picture taken at the bottom of one of the big hill climbs, the Alpe d'Huez, of, I think it was the guy who was actually last in the whole race.
Oh.
He's struggling. He's really struggling to get up the hill. And you can see, you know, all the effort and that. And in front of him is this road that winds up
yeah.
from these huge Alps. And you can see this big S shape. And right in the distance, you can see all the other cyclists who are fighting, you know, to win the race. And this poor guy is
he's miles.
Right at the back.
He's at the broom wagon stage, then, is he?
Well, yeah, he's kind of red lantern, you know, he's right right back at the Lantern Rouge, I suppose I would say. But that's what... the combination of the two factors, the effort you can see, because you can see all the sinews in his body as he's struggling and he's weaving about, but also the shape taking you up to it. It makes for a really powerful image. And that's what you're trying to achieve all the time with photography. You're trying to get to convey an emotion,
yes,
to convey an impression, to give a feeling. So those are the kind of the key mathematical principles. The other thing to bear in mind is balance. If you've got two things, you know, you can either balance them symmetrically or asymmetrically. So if you've got, I'm trying to think, you know, a nice big tree in the distance that you really want to be the subject, but a lot of other space around it, having a small bush nearer you gives you that asymmetrical balance between the two things. Sometimes if you're photographing a building and you've got another building close by that's similar size, you can use that to just balance the image out. But it really, you know, it depends on how you want to create the image.
Wow. It makes you really think about everything you look at, because when people photograph things, you know, when you talk about this, the rule of thirds,
yes,
you know, if you take a picture on a mobile phone and you crop it, generally you can move that grid. It is a grid on which is on it my is. Phone. You can yeah. don't move it. So actually, the centre of the image is actually somebody's face or what you want it to be.
Yeah.
So it's doing that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have that the focus of the image in that centre part, does it? It
no.
means it has to be in...
You can be in the centre. And obviously for some, you know, if you're just doing a straight headshot of somebody, that works well. But for most scenics and portraits, actually having things slightly off-centre is much more pleasing to look at.
Yeah, it draws your eye in.
Yeah, it just makes it more interesting. And I still don't know why it is. I couldn't. There have been books written on this, whole books on why it is. But it's the way the mind works. It's the way that the eye connects to the brain. It just does.
But it's all maths, is it? It's like
at the end of the day,
it's all mathematics.
It's common everyday use of mathematics, but you don't need to get too worried about it. Just have that thought in your mind when you're looking at an image. And as you say, if you don't get it right first time, you can fix it in post-processing, you know, because you can crop it a bit, you can move things around in a picture with your mobile or with Photoshop if you use that.
So in terms of the geometry of an image as a photographer, if you're displaying your prints, what's the most common thing that you would be after? Or is it a massive combination of all the different rules?
It is a bit of a combination, but they kind of go in sequence. So certainly, and you know, you'll get a chance to look at 100 and odd of these, 180
yes.
images in a couple of weeks, because we'll be at Sheffield Cathedral. But from my starting point, I always, when I'm taking a picture, over time, you tend to have these at the back of your mind anyway. But then when you get them back and you put them on the computer and start messing with them, the first thing I look for is kind of the rule of thirds. Does this look natural? Does it work well there? And a lot of my pictures you'll see apply to that. I mean, interestingly, we just run this competition for the public for
yes.
the first time ever. We've done that. And we've picked the four winners. And I would say, I'm just trying to think of all of them. So we've got a sports shot.
Yes, I saw that.
A portrait yeah. image and two landscapes. Certainly the sports shot and the portrait image very much fit the rule of thirds.
Yes.
The main subject in both cases is on the third. If you look at the portrait, they've used the principle of balance because they've used a model and a tall building in the background to balance the image. And both of those images are on a third. So one's on the left third, one's on the right third. The landscapes, where they put the horizon,
yes.
is on the third. So people, and you know, the guys who sent them in, some of them I think are quite accomplished photographers. Some of them I don't think have done a lot. But it's amazing how often the image
fits,
conforms to these rules.
It's almost subconscious. It's subconscious, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
the way the eyes work and all that.
Yeah, so. we were down at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. And we saw a piece of art. This guy, we were having a tour, and they took us to this piece of art, and they said this was... I'll have to get Paul to Google it. I can't remember what it was called. But the artist, he was the first person to paint with perspective, in the sense that it wasn't just a portrait of a person or a bowl of fruit or anything.
Right.
It drew your eye. It was like a fox. Not a, it was deer hunting, and it drew your eye into the distance. Everything was taking you in. And he said that was so significant. He was the first artist who's ever done that. He'd given perspective. And I can't remember for the life of me now what it's called.
It was in a forest, wasn't it?
It was a forest. A very old painting. But it was... And for, to be told that, that's the first time anybody had thought...
Well, it's amazing, the use of perspective. Because these rules, I mean, they apply through photography and art, but also to geometry. If you look at the Parthenon in Athens... square on at the front, it follows the golden ratio.
Yes.
Absolutely, perfectly. And that gives you that. That's why it's such a pleasing building, I think.
Yeah, pleasing on the eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just, and it's just, you know, and that's been around for how many thousands of years? The pyramids follow the principle of leading lines. Yeah. That's exactly the way they were designed. Not just the individual pyramids, but the way they were laid out. In, if you go to the Valley of the Kings, this whole structure is designed to give you that perspective.
Yeah, amazing. So it doesn't really make you think. So I'm looking forward to, we will be coming to the exhibition at the cathedral. So I'll be looking forward to trying to work out what rules have been applied.
Some of them are, I mean, there are people who always break the rules, you know, like Jackson Pollock. You always get the Jackson Pollocks where, you know, it's completely abstract and random. So there'll be a few of those as well.
But, yeah, but that all adds to the mix. All good stuff. Brilliant. Really interesting chat. And when you talk about perspective and things like the rules of the mathematics, it always makes me think of Canaletto's, because he was a massive on detail, but massive on perspective.
Yeah, I think whoever, you know, Da Vinci, you think about the Mona Lisa, that is a perfect example of a Fibonacci spiral.
Yeah.
Where her eyes are follows if you drew it. That's
amazing.
Where the eyes end up.
You see, who knew? Eh? We once went to the Louvre just to see the Mona Lisa. Took us ages to get home. And it's tiny. We couldn't believe.
It's a bit disappointing, isn't it?
I know. Because you think it's massive and it's about, anyway. But there you go. So it makes you think, look at art and photographs in a different way as to why things work. Fantastic chat, Gareth, as always.
Super.
Thank you very much. And all being well, we may even see you at the cathedral.
Yes,
if
hopefully.
You are
let me know when you go.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yes,
I'll
be there.
Thanks a lot, Gareth.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Shapes are things before my eyes. Just teach me to despise. Will time make man more wise? Here, within my just hurt my brain, but will it seem the same?
lost me bit of paper. Give it back, give it back. Oh, great track there. That was Shapes of Things by the Yardbirds way back in 1966. We played that because we're talking to Gareth Morgan, who's a member of and also ex-president of the Sheffield Photographic Society, talking about the geometry of an image. Fascinating chat will make you think about what you look at in terms of photography and pictures. Don't forget the Sheffield Photographic Society annual exhibition is at Sheffield Cathedral. It runs from Friday the 28th of March until Sunday the 6th of April. Well worth doing. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We've just got time for a bit of an environment update before we let the film show take over. And we are fast running out of time. So a very quick story here. According to new data, levels of toxic nitrogen dioxide gas have fallen by 27% across London since the expansion of the ultra-low emission zone, or the ULEZ, in 2023. For PM2.5, which is particulate matter from exhaust linked to asthma and heart problems, the decrease is 31% in outer London, while the number of non-compliant vehicles has fallen by 58%. The decision to expand the ULEZ was not something I took lightly, Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, said, but this report shows it was the right one for the health of all Londoners. All good stuff. Bye-bye. Outside. Through her skin, I've been out before, but this time it's much safer in. Last night, in the sky, ooh, such a bright light. My radar sent me danger, but my instincts tell me to. Our charm.